All right, so hi everyone, welcome. Pretty exciting today. We've got one of my colleagues who I've worked with some time ago in this space, who's still in this space, and it's very exciting to have him here. It's Hillel Cohen. So you're here today now, no longer with Novartis and Sandoz. He's recently retired. Are you a year in yet? How long have you been retired?
1 year, 3 months.
1 year, 3.
But who's
Who's counting?
counting?
So 1 year,
But I
three
actually,
months.
but since I retired, I've actually published three peer-reviewed articles on it, and I'm actually working on a fourth.
Oh, good for you. Yeah, so if
So
you're
I'm
in this space, so
still in the space.
if you're listening to this podcast, you very likely know who Hillel Cohen is. So we appreciate you being here today, Hillel. So thank you. So when we decided to do this, you and I saw each other out at the Festival of Biologics in California this year, and you were kind enough to sit at a table and lead a group of individuals and had a conversation around, harmonization, the concepts of, what around harmonization should we look to, and what should we do from a biosimilars perspective around harmonization. And we'll get into that later in the podcast, but that's kind of what sparked the idea. We said, we do this podcast about every 2 months. We would love to have you on to talk a little bit about, biosimilars, and again, definitely about this harmonization piece. But before we start to get into some of the nitty-gritty stuff about biosimilars, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little about yourself, your history, who are you, and how did you end up in doing science and biosimilars?
This goes back a little more than 20, 25 years in the area of biosimilars. I was working at Novartis Pharmaceuticals and then to Novartis Vaccines. And I actually represented the Novartis interests to the trade associations when we were talking about a brand new class of products called follow-on protein products. There's a period of time when people weren't even sure if it could be made. The Novartis position was that we think it can be made, and actually, we think the science is there already. At that time, we already were working on growth hormones. So I continued working in biosimilars as the pathway was being developed. Discussions with the various trade associations, who then had discussions with the FDA on and legal teams on how it should be codified in law. Some of the initial guidances as well. I ended up moving over to Sandoz in 2014, and I was there for quite a few years. And that's also one of the industry negotiators for the Biosimilar User Fee Act for both the second and third iterations. I also chaired the first advisory committee for a biosimilar. That's when we first had them. That was the first biosimilar to be approved in the US, Zarxio, which was a filgrastim with Sandoz. So I've actually been in the biosimilar space for quite a while. I've actually always focused on the science, and I've had a decent amount of publications that fortunately a number of people have cited over the years.
Well,
It's not just.
you've had more than a decent number of publication allows, and we appreciate everything you've contributed to the space. Talking about biosimilars, you mentioned it already briefly and gave some background. But before we get into some of the topics you and I wanted to discuss, can you tell us, and keep it simple, can you tell us for by chance, if there's someone listening to this who isn't in our space, can you keep it simple? So when you say biosimilars, what is a biosimilar?
Well, there's really three major things. A biosimilar is a biological drug, which may need to be explained by itself what a
Right.
biological drug is.
Right.
But assuming you get past that point, it's a functional copy of a biological drug that provides the same efficacy and works the same way. So there's no real difference in safety or effectiveness. Now, think of it as three buckets.
Okay.
The first, when you want to make a copy of a biological drug, you have to really know what is the structure, and of those elements of the structure, which were those really most important that contribute to its efficacy and safety. So that means you have to get multiple lots of the product you want to copy, which is the reference biological product, and you have to analyze the hell out of it with the best possible science. Once you determine the structure that you want, you then have to design a molecule of your own, and starting with cell lines and purification processes, and then you end up maybe with a whole bunch of possible clones, and you choose the one that really closely matches the product you want.
Okay.
The closer the match, the better you are. And over time, we've seen companies have gotten progressively better at making these copies. The third major aspect is head-to-head comparisons of the reference product and your proposed product. So it's mostly analytics. Then there's the biological portion of analytics to show that biologically it works the same in the cell line system or something like that. There's then a confirmation in the human system, typically pharmacokinetics or pharmacodynamics. I explained it. Pharmacokinetics is what happens to the drug in the body. Pharmacodynamics is what happens to the body when you administer the drug. But they're both of them are very sensitive. So that's generally the type of clinical tests that we want to do right now. It's not the efficacy test. The efficacy test is very broad acceptance criteria, but the PK and if available PD studies are really the strongest tests.
Okay.
That, and you should think of them as confirmation, because the bedrock of biosimilars has always been the analytics. And that's an area where the analytics have gotten progressively stronger over time.
That's very good. That's very helpful, though. Thank you. And I would not explain this to adults working in the science and people who are in this space as necessarily copies per se. But if I was explaining this to my son who just got done with his chemistry course and is thinking about maybe biochem, I would talk about, I would to keep it simple, I'd probably say they're essentially or close to copies. Now, of course, we know they're not copies because you can't really copy it, but they're essentially copies. It's almost like the biological form of a small molecule generic. I know there's more complexities than that. We get that, but if that's that would be an easier way to describe it. So.
Don't undersell it, because quite honestly, you're starting with you do really have an identical amino acid sequence. That is a direct copy. The secondary structures that are formed when you grow up or purify something, that may be different,
Right.
but you really are starting out with an identical amino acid sequence.
Yeah, I appreciate the clarity. Thank you. You mentioned a few things on as far as getting the reference products and trying to analytical test, clinical test. We hear about streamlining a lot, right? So I know we in the space we talk about all the time. It's really gained a lot of traction as far as streamlining biosimilar development. In your own words, can you talk a little about streamlining the biosimilar development?
Biosimilar, remember, it started out in the early aughts, 2008 or there, 2010 thereabouts. And at the time, health authorities, most, had not approved biosimilars. So it was somewhat conservative.
Right.
Since that time, the analytical tests that we perform have become much more precise and exact. You can talk about mass spec, where it's six orders of magnitude, that's 100,000 times more sensitive now than it was when biosimilars first came to the market.
Wow.
It's an amazing amount. There are tests that were done at the outset that we know don't bring any value. I mean, animal testing, what animal t testing immunogenicity of a human protein like a biosimilar in an animal, of course it's going to be immunogenic. It's not the same.
Right.
But at the time, you didn't really know that. People weren't sure. So there are things that we have learned. We've also learned how little you learn from the comparative efficacy studies that everyone wanted 20 years ago. But now people are realizing, we have 70 biosimilars approved in the US, even larger number in Europe. For almost all of them, you really didn't learn anything with this large, expensive comparative clinical efficacy study. That you didn't already know from the analytics. We didn't know that 20 years ago. Streamlining development is not cutting corners at all on safety, effectiveness, or even the quality of the science. It's basically focusing on the assays that we now know are most important and on the type of tests that we know are most important. So people should realize streamlining development is not cutting corners,
Yeah, and I
but is
appreciate that.
focusing what's important.
Yeah, and I appreciate that emphasis. It's a really good way to set to describe it. It's like without question, it's not changing the goalpost. It's not cutting corners. We're simply relying. We've learned over the last 10, 20 years. We learned all the last 10, 20 years, and we've developed better methods. The science has evolved and improved, as you mentioned, numerous folds, where we can actually use analytics to a much greater degree now with more consistency and accuracy and probably precision. than we used to be able to 10, 20 years ago. And with that, there likely is much less of a need, if at all, for some of these comparative clinical studies, as we've talked. That's definitely one element of streamline we've talked a lot. And that's definitely one of the elements that's gaining a lot of traction, which is really good, because now we won't get into it in this podcast, but it's costly to do research to develop a biosimilar. It's costly for any company. And the idea here is, at least in the US, and there was also a paper in the UK, there's a biosimilar void. And this is something the AAM's Biosimilar Council released about a year ago. And that has to do with the number of biologics that'll lose patent protection over the next 10 years, and how a good number of those products, I believe it's 100, 118, if I recall the number, but
Around 80%, 80
thank
to
you. 80,
85%.
80% of biologics aren't under development, so you won't have any competition that will actually reduce the cost for patients and hopefully better access to these products because of that lower cost. So with that void, with that potentially not doing any research development, again, we'll get into this deeper in a different podcast. But the idea here is, if we can reduce the cost, get companies to think about really thinking about research development for some of these other biosimilars, that'll actually make sure, hopefully, having other biologics or biosimilars to the market sooner, which is what streamlining can do. It can do that without cutting quality, like you're saying, without reducing safety and efficacy. So we're not cutting corners. So
I think
I
absolutely.
appreciate that.
That's a good
Okay.
way of putting it. I think it's, I wouldn't focus as much on the, when we say it's the cost of development is lower, that also means that more companies will be willing to invest and develop
Sure,
biosimilars,
exactly.
which means we'll address the biosimilar void. At the time the biosimilar started around 20 years ago, I remember hearing from several companies that the cutoff was $1 billion in sales. If the reference product didn't have $1 billion in sales, they
Interesting.
weren't going to develop a biosimilar to it. Things have now changed, but so many of these biologics you're mentioning as part of the void don't sell at $1 billion or more.
Yeah.
But by lowering the development cost, you now enable biosimilars to be developed to those products. The other thing that the biostreamlining does is it speeds up the process.
Yeah.
The large-scale clinical trials are actually the single most expensive part, and they don't add anything.
Right.
But it's also, it adds a year or two of development. And if you can basically get products to patients faster, that's a win-win, certainly for the patients.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get back to this harmonization idea, okay? And before we get into, like, maybe some differences and pros and cons, can you just give us a high level, just off the top of your head, some high level, what were some of the things when you sat at that table at the Biosimilars or Festival of Biologics, what were some of the topics that were brought up during that talk?
Well, there actually were what I expected. The most common ones were things like animal testing, which fortunately it seems to be going away. Some health authorities are now acknowledging that comparative clinical efficacy studies are really not that helpful. So that's actually interesting because there you have the more experienced health authorities have taken that position and are moving in that direction. The less experienced health authorities are still looking towards that because that provides, believe it or not, the term comfort blanket,
We've heard
that was
that.
brought up by Sarah Youngman of the FDA. That was the
No,
term she used.
I want to push back a little tiny bit. When I heard that first term used, some time ago, we had the IPRP public workshop. It was a 2-day workshop for the public and regulators that are part of the IPRP, and they held a health authority only type of closed door meeting after that. And if I recall correctly, I'd have to go back and check. I don't think it was Sarah Yim. I think it might have been the Health Canada contingent that brought up the term comfort blanket. But someone did, to your
Oh,
point, right?
it was certainly at that meeting. We
Right,
both listened
sure,
to that meeting.
exactly.
I thought it was Sarah Yim. It could have been somebody else. And if it was somebody else, she certainly picked it up and kept using the term.
Okay,
Okay.
fair enough, fair enough.
But that's another one. That's one. The idea of the global reference product, where do you purchase a reference product? Again, going back 20, 25 years, every health authority wanted to make sure that you did the testing against the product licensed in their country. What we've now learned, especially with the analytics, is that the reference product is manufactured generally in one location in one country. Rarely is it made in more than one country. Very rarely, if ever. At most, you may have different release criteria. But high quality manufacturers are not going to manufacture different quality. Everything, they're going to stick to the same high quality. That's true for any biologic manufacturer, whether it's an originator or a biosimilar. You have one quality standard globally. And it should be reflected. So why do you have to repeat the assays or analytics with local reference products? And then there's some questions, some topics that got brought up that I hadn't ever thought of before. If you have a device with a software component, as you actually have with some of the insulin delivery devices, there's an issue of software compliance and and patient data sharing. I mean, it's common in every country. Some countries more than other. Very in Europe, it's very important, and it's important in the U.S. as well. But that's something that when you're developing a device, that's something you're gonna have to start thinking about.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's a good
And
one. Yeah, and we do hear this issue regarding device, at least in the US. I'll speak briefly about the US. We do hear issues about the comparability of devices and how you want to work with health authorities and figure out what's the right amount of data, what's the data they need. When you talk about comparability of devices on the biosimilar side
yeah,
of this of our space. So that's
that was yeah.
helpful.
Yeah, that
So
was my
okay, so
presentation. That was my presentation to the Festival of Biologics, where I think there's more attention needs to be given to the comparability of devices than
yeah,
we've
and
been talking about
it's
so far.
definitely one thing. I'll put a little plug here real quick for GRX and BioSims coming up here in October 27th to the 29th here in Rockville or North Bethesda. We will have a session on comparability and specifically focused on devices for biosimilars. And we hopefully, of course, are working to get the FDA, which they've always been very good about attending and using that forum as a nice communication tool for them. So we hope to have a nice session on that. Just a quick little plug for our conference. So tell me, let me ask you a little more specifics real quick on harmonization. Can you give me an example or like talk about, how different are the pathways for some of the major markets, some of the major health authorities such as like EU, US, and Canada? So when you think about developing a biosimilar for those jurisdictions, how different are some of the regulations? And what are some of the challenges when companies are doing that?
Again, going back 20 years, they were really quite divergent. I'll give an example. I mentioned the filgrastim. The sponsor company conducted three PK and PD studies. The Europeans said that's sufficient. No need for comparative efficacy studies. And the FDA at that time said, no, we want, this is going to be the first biosimilar. We need a comparative efficacy study. So that was a strange situation where the clinical data package was actually different between Europe and the US. You have another issue, place where it's different, and it's maybe based on the law. If you come up with a different mechanism means of delivery in intramuscular versus subcutaneous, in Europe, it's considered just an extension. When it's done in the US at present, they would want to have it as a separate clinical study. And a company that did that, got their product license in Europe as an extension. For the US, they need to do a separate efficacy study. So there are some differences in the clinical data packages. The PK study, you have some in the weeds differences where the endpoints, some of the scientists in the Europe think they should end, they should have a certain margin. In the FDA, they believe maybe the margin should be slightly different. So a company developing clinical trial has to be develop it for the most conservative viewpoints. Yes. Now you really want to have a clinical package done in one country that's acceptable everywhere in the world. There are some countries around the world where they still want to see some patients from their own populations being included. And that's against the concept of biosimilarity, but again, biosimilars are new and compared to all the other drugs. I mean, if the reference products who had to study this particular molecule in different populations, different ages, and they established through a very rigorous development program, and it's not cheap, that the product works or works well, and maybe needs to be dosing that needs to be adjusted, but that's already been established. What you really need to do for biosimilar is saying, look, I have the same structure. I've proven it's the same structure
Right.
in all the clinically important parameters, and we've done a confirmatory clinical study showing that in a sensitive patient population that it works the same. You don't have to repeat the wheel. That's the whole essence of biosimilarity. You do need to prove it, but once it's proven, it could be used across the board.
And you
That's
said you don't have to repeat the wheel, I think you said, but like, I think that's fair. So I was gonna, on that thread here, let's pull on that a little bit and tell me, in your mind, what are some of the most burdensome, at least in your mind currently, not even more, like you said, it has evolved over time, which is great, and it's moving in the right direction, which we're very happy for and we continue to advocate for. But in your mind, what's currently still some of the more burdensome redundancies when it comes to seeking approval in different parts of the globe?
well, it's really coming up with a clinical program that all regions of the world agree with. And even, I already said that the clinical program is the least sensitive. But it's really going to, generally speaking, if you come in with a strong analytical package, most countries will accept it. It actually could be a little bit of a problem, and we talked about that at the Festival of Biologics meeting. Because now when you start developing new technologies, mass spec-based technologies, which are really cutting edge, very sensitive, very precise, but they're also new for many health authorities. So a health authority says, you know, that's great, but we still want to see a peptide map with UV tracing as opposed to a mass spec analysis. I mean, and that's really getting into the weeds, but both of them develop fingerprints of the molecule once it's been digested, the various fragments. So if science advances and the FDA is willing to accept something and it's brand new across the board, it'll be a while before all countries around the world come to accept it in the same manner. There's a little bit of a lag there.
So on that, all countries have improved in the same manner. So how long? So I'm just curious, in your mind, so how far in the future do you believe we're in a place where biosimilar can be improved in one trusted partner, a well-regulated health authority, where it would be eligible in others? And I know because there's pockets that, look, not every jurisdiction has the resources that the US does, right? So at what point do you think we'll get to a place, and how far, where we will have an approval in one well-trusted, highly competent health authority, where others will say, "Okay, you're approved in the U.S., for example, or in the EU, you're good to go here as well." How far are we away from that?
I think the science will get there a lot faster than the policy and politics will get there.
Gotcha.
So I personally, my own personal opinion is, I'm speaking as an individual, I think the science is there already. However, policy-wise, politics-wise, I'll give you an example. If a product is developed in Russia or in Iran, I'm not so sure it'll be accepted all that quickly in the US. Now, having said that, I'm not picking on any of those countries one way or the other. I just pick on those because those they actually have companies developing biosimilars in those regions. I'm not sure that those products that are being developed would meet the standards of the FDA or the EMA because they haven't been licensed. They haven't been subjected to regulatory review. My point simply being that there are issues other than pure science at play here. So I think personally the science is there already. It's
That's
going to
fair.
take more than the science.
That's helpful. It's a good response, Lil. Good response. And surprisingly, Lil, these podcasts go a lot faster than you think. We're in a really good place. We're gonna actually start closing, believe it or not. That's how quick it is. But a
Wow.
couple things to close. What would you say? What would you say? Now that you're on your own, you can speak your own mind. What would you say to regulators who are hesitant to move away from some of these, for example, even clinical trial requirements? I know we're having great conversations here in the US, and now there's some proposed legislation that's starting to make its way through. But what would you say to regulators who are hesitant to move away from the legacy kind of clinical trial requirements?
I'd say you have to follow the science. That's really where it goes. Not surprising from someone who's a scientist, but you follow the science and you follow what's important. At the end of the day, what's important is bringing products, high quality products, to patients quickly. And that's really what you want to do. Follow the science, you'll get there. The science is there already. That's what I would tell those health authorities. There's an element of education involved. I think there's an element of education. Anytime you have a biosimilars to new therapeutic area, you have to educate patients, parents, physicians.
Healthcare professor, right, physicians, right.
So healthcare, and but you also have to educate the health authorities themselves.
Yeah.
There are efforts in that are already ongoing, and I think the International Pharmaceutical Regulatory Program that you mentioned, the IPRP, we just threw out the acronym. That's what it really means.
Thank you,
The
sir.
regulators around the world get together and discuss it. I know that you're working with colleagues, and the International Council on Harmonization is developing a revised biosimilar guidance. Those two will go a long way towards, I think, getting the global harmonization and getting everyone on the same page.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Hello, I appreciate your time. I think it's good to end with something like, hey, how do we solve this? Well, follow the science. I think it's very important. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. We are going to do this again in the future as far as AAM's Biosimilar Council. Again, we're trying to do these every 2 to 3 months. We'll bring on guests and amazing guests like Hillel every so often. We appreciate it. So Hillel, we might invite you back.
I have all my family and friends calling. Watch out.
There you go. Hey, well, thank you for your time. It's all from personally, it's always a pleasure seeing you and talking with you. So for you, please give my best to your family and have a wonderful day, my friend. Thank you so much.
And thank you really to you and everyone listening for having me on. It's been a pleasure.